Welcome to Just One Q, the podcast where we explore the latest ideas in workplace diversity, equity, and inclusion in conversation with thought leaders and DEI experts. Each episode, I ask our guests just one question, highlighting their area of expertise in DEI. The goal is to leave you with the tools and insights that you need to drive change in your own life, both personally and professionally. I'm your host, Dominique Attrell. I'm a diversity, equity, and inclusion educator and advocate working in the DEI and e-learning consultancy Dialectic in Guelph, Ontario. On this week's episode, I'm joined by Sara Sayed. Sara is the City of Guelph's Senior Policy Advisor for Equity, Anti-Racism, and Indigenous Initiatives, which is a relatively new role at the city. And she has extensive professional experience in community organizing, consulting, strategic planning, and leadership. Sara has served as a community services director for the Muslim Society of Guelph, has been on the Leadership Council of the Guelph-Wellington Local Immigration Partnership, and she serves as a board member for the Guelph General Hospital and for the Guelph Community Foundation. Hello, Sara. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Thanks so much for being here. I'm really excited about this conversation, too. The question we're going to explore together today is, how can we address systemic racism at the municipal level? And on this show, we talk a lot about workplace DEI. We talk about equitable hiring and advancement. We talk about, you know, responding to microaggressions in the workplace or developing strategic approaches to DEI in a more corporate setting. But in conversation with you, Sara, I'd love to broaden this conversation and to think beyond the typical corporate workplace. I want to talk about structural racism that's built into the towns and cities where we all live and what it takes to address that. So I'm not going to drown this in context. Instead, I'd really love to dive in and to hear from you. So could you tell us about how systemic racism manifests in the programs and policies of municipalities? Just sharing a few examples to situate our listeners.
For sure. So when we're talking about the municipal level, we're not talking just about, you know, our internal workplace. We're talking really about how our policies and programs, services, processes, how all of those things affect the residents of the city and how we, you know, function from day to day. So we really have to take a lens to look at how those things are happening. And if you really think about it, our services, our structure, everything, it benefits a segment of the community for the majority of the time, but it excludes a lot of other people at other times. There's mm-hmm. If there's always some sort of issue or question or thought that you have to say, like, can I or how will I, then that means there's a barrier in place. Mm. So if you're accessing city services and things like this, then you should not have to be faced with those kinds of questions before you're coming in, because this is your day-to-day function and how you move about on a regular basis. So one of my favorite examples, and this the Guelph Public Library did just shortly before I started working with the city, is they eliminated all of the library fines. Mm-hmm. And at that time, you know, not a big deal, nobody said much. But when budget time came and they requested a little bit of an increase in their budget to make up for some of those losses, you know, people were really upset. Well, why would you get rid of fines? If people can't get things back on time, then they should have to pay a fine for it. And we really didn't think about how it was affecting others or who was really being affected by these. Because on a regular basis, average people, it's a lot more common now to access books digitally, yeah, to access audiobooks, to just go and buy your books because yeah, they're more accessible now. So who's using the library? So the people that are using the library, those fines are then, you know, causing barriers or obstructions for them to be accessing internet, Wi-Fi, mm-hmm, an actual laptop or a computer, entertainment when they can't afford streaming. If you don't have a good connection to your home, you know, your streaming services are buffering. That's the most annoying thing when you're watching movies. Yeah. And if you have small children screaming at the TV because you can't get 20 minutes to prepare dinner, yes, and maybe keep them busy, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
It's just an added stress to your daily stress levels, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And we saw this a lot during the pandemic where kids had to head to the library to submit their assignments because they didn't have connections at home. They didn't have access to a tablet or whatever they needed. And so those were the people who then couldn't access those services mm-hmm. if they had 25 cents or 30 cents. And that's a big deal if you're on a fixed income or a very limited budget. So eliminating those fines really made a huge difference for a huge amount of people that were accessing services that were an absolute necessity. They were not just for, you know, extras.
Yeah.
So you don't realize that until you're in that situation.
Yeah.
That's one of, I think, one great example of systemic barriers that were eliminated by a simple, simple move in policy, but made a huge difference for a lot of people.
That's amazing. What a great example. I can also think of, you know, transportation being another easy one, right? Where like the cost of riding the bus, especially during the pandemic when things were tight for people and they didn't have extra resources to draw from necessarily. And housing being another key issue. I'm sure the city has a lot of different housing policies and has involvement there with land planning and zoning and all of that kind of stuff. So these are, you know, very deep equity issues that affect people. And this is beyond what we see in just a workplace, right? We're talking about people's ability to feed themselves, people's ability to have housing, people's ability to just exist and live and move through the world. So it really does transcend what we experience in the DEI context in a more corporate setting when we're talking about, you know, maybe benefits or not benefits or time off or things like that that seem arbitrary compared to these sort of more major and more essential services. Thank you for sharing that example. I'm going to ask you next, what are some of the most transformative anti-racist practices that can be implemented at the municipal level? What are the ways that we can most quickly and effectively figure out where the racism is being felt, where structural inequality is being felt, where accessibility needs are being felt, and really root them out?
Well, I think it's important to look at everything, we call it through an equity lens or an equity toolkit. And it's four basic questions. Who is being excluded? Why are they being excluded? What are the repercussions of them being excluded? And then how do we move forward and change that? And when you really sit back and think about, and not just operate from a lens of, well, the majority can do this, or, you know, two-thirds of our people can access these services. Mm-hmm. So that's a great amount. Well, what about the one-third? How, you know, what's the effect on them? What are the repercussions? And how much change is it actually going to take to make sure that that other group, and I'm throwing out random numbers, I have no data whatsoever right now. It's just, you know, how do we make sure that that group of people is also included? And sometimes it could actually be working in the other way. It could be just a small minority are able to access the service the way it is, and it's set there because it's always just been that way.
Yeah.
And we've never really thought about why it's been this way. And now we're realizing that a majority of people actually cannot access a certain service mm-hmm. or cannot get to point A to B because of, you know, the neighborhood happens to be planned. So as more and more research gets done, places get designated that this is a food desert based on how difficult it is to get to a store or a food bank or somewhere where you can purchase food or obtain food. In details like this, because we've always operated under the assumption that everyone has transportation.
Right.
And now we have to rethink, you know, what is our transportation looking like? What is our transit system looking like? What are our trails looking like? So all of those things, as we really dive into who can access them and who can't access them and why are those people being excluded from that, I think that's some of the simplest questions you can ask for a policy or a service or a program to really just think about how it's being used.
Yeah, absolutely. That brings to my mind, so I don't have, for just for the record, I don't have a very strong background in municipal planning, but some of my colleagues have been steeped in that world and I have sort of some peripheral experience with it. And a frame that has come up and that I have found really useful, it's very similar like to the four questions that you've just asked, but it's something called liberatory design. And this is something that it's kind of a collection of both mindsets and modes of working. And the point of it is to really shift the relationship between people who have the power to design policies or make decisions and those who are impacted by all of those decisions and design choices. And so the goal is then to create collective liberation. And there are sort of within this resource questions that are really similar to the ones that you've just asked. So, you know, the act of noticing, who am I? You know, who are we collectively in our work together? What is my and our team's relationship to opportunity and to institutional power? Seeing the system. So what inequitable patterns of experience are there, and how are these outcomes playing out in our systems? How do we know? You know, what are we measuring? And then empathizing. So like, who is closest to the pain? Who is furthest from the power? Who is at the table or not at the table? So this resource, and I'll throw a link to it, they're at the bottom in the show notes, but it's a really great encapsulation of some of these thoughts and questions that can drive that. And then there's the work of how, once you have this awareness, right? Once you're asking the right questions, sometimes the things that we need to do to create that inclusion, and even for community consultation, for example, can be quite extensive. So what are some things that we can do to draw people into processes from which they might be traditionally excluded?
Yeah, we've been working a lot on how we engage and how we communicate with the residents of the city, because I think that's one of your first kind of foundational steps. If you don't hear the voices, then you don't know who's being excluded.
Right.
If you don't hear the voices, then you don't know why they're being excluded. So getting to the voices, so really moving out into the city and going to the places where people are has mm-hmm. been one huge change. Realizing the emotional labor that people have to give time and time again when they're asked by organizations, by municipality, by others, you know, what are the issues? So recognizing that and really figuring out a way to help compensate and support that.
Mm-hmm.
Because most of the people who are doing the community work are doing that on a volunteer basis. They're doing it above and beyond, trying to keep, you know, a job to keep food on the table. And yeah. then they're passionate about this work and helping other people. And so they're doing that. So that's really important, is to go to the people, recognize the amount of work and questions. You know, we come back, sit behind our desks, process everything, put it into a flowchart or, you know, a spreadsheet. But time and time again, having those community folks come out and tell you what the issues are, or taking too much time to even act on what you've been told,
yeah.
Is something that we really have to work on. And the engagement, I think, is a huge piece of that, and really rethinking how we engage with people and meeting them in their place of comfort and safety is a huge, that would be a game changer if we can really get the resources out to do that.
Yeah.
Once you hear from people, then you know where the changes have to be made and what the effects really are, the ramifications of what we're doing.
Yeah, that's great. So what I'm hearing is, you know, going to people in the spaces where they are, compensating people for their time. I know sometimes that can mean even things like offering childcare or meals or transportation to community consultation events, and then closing the loop so that people feel like the information that they share is actually being processed and heard and put into action. So those are really valuable insights. And is there, I know that you've talked a little bit about creating safe spaces as well. Do you want to tell me a little bit more about what that means in the context of this work?
Yeah, I think safety has a really different definition for everyone, really depending on who they are, what their lived experience may be, and where, what their life journey has been. So mm-hmm. it really has a different context for everyone. And so really making sure that the city is available and accessible in a way that is safe and comfortable to all the residents. So I had said before, it's not just a place where we're working. It's not just a place where we're going to school. It's a place where we're also relaxing, or we want to engage in things that are fun, just mm-hmm. have time for ourselves. So really, you're looking at making a municipality or a community where you can engage economically, socially, as well as politically, and or in a civic sense, and culturally.
Right.
So having all of those places where you feel safe, comfortable, can connect with, whether it's going out for a bite to eat or catching a show, something that is, you know, that speaks to you, that
right.
reflects you, something that is of your interest, as well as schools and programs, recreational facilities that you can access easily, where you can have programming that's suitable for you, that you can play sports and games that, you know, not necessarily competitive. They can be recreational. They
right.
can be competitive. You know, for the aspiring, you know, Olympic athlete, there is resources for them as well
yes.
as for, you know, the weekend pickleballer.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, you need to have that accessibility. And then it needs to be there, like not just Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, but in the evenings, on the weekends, you know, when people have time. Not
yes.
everybody works a 9 to 5, so you have people working shift work. So how do we make sure that there are services and accessible areas according to those, you know, work-life schedules? And so just all of the things, you know, you have to be able to participate in your fullest sense as,
absolutely.
As your full person. So how do we make that place safe and comfortable for you to do it here and not have to leave the city to go and do something that might be fun or might be a required service, but you can't get it here. So
right.
you know, we need to really think about that and make sure that all of those places are available for our residents.
So, Sara, there are so many things to consider. The scale of this task is just really hitting me, like in terms of how much work there is. And you are just one person in a large organization. So I'd love to hear from you about how your job is structured, maybe how the location of your role within the organization helps support the changes that you're making. And do you feel like you actually have the ability to make meaningful change from the position that you're in? And if so, why? How? Share with us.
Yeah, it is a daunting task, but you have to start somewhere, and it all starts with one person, one step at a time. But if we are to be really serious about the changes that we want to make, whether it's private sector or public sector, we really have to make sure that this position or this department or however it looks is in a place that these folks are in the room with decision makers.
Yes.
And those decision makers are ready for what, you know, many would consider radical change. And for a lot of people, it's just obvious change.
Yeah.
So depending on the view that you're looking at it from. And so you need to be positioned close to those actual change makers, because you don't want your policy or your changes getting watered down by the time they're going through levels and levels of approval.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes it can come off, I guess it's two ways. Either, you know, A, this position or department is not doing the job it's supposed to be doing, because you could have something get to the top and then, you know, that person might be ready for radical change and they're looking at your policy going, yeah, it's not going to make that much of a difference. But,
right.
you know, your levels of managers in between might be fearful or worried and watering things down as it goes.
Yes. Yeah.
Or you may just be buried in another department because the people at the top of, you know, that power structure are not ready for change. So it could be kind of two different ways, two sides of the coin.
Yeah.
But you need to be in a place where you have that support, those change champions and people that are ready to work with you and support you. And I've been very lucky at the city that I have a team that has been amazing, very supportive of the changes, but also they're there when you need a break. They're there to make you laugh. They're a wonderful, very supportive team in every way possible, as well as, you know, being ready to make those changes. The appetite is there. Everyone that I talk to across departments, the appetite is there. It's just, for the most part, you know, these policies and systems we have are so old.
Yeah.
That it's about changing entire parameters. It's not just making changes within the same parameters all the time.
Right.
We have to make some radical changes, and sometimes that's really beyond our control because we're provincially mandated or federally mandated. And so really working in those confines,
yeah.
gets difficult.
Yeah.
But there's a want there. There's a realization that things have to change. So I think I've been lucky in my position, speaking with some other colleagues, counterparts across municipalities. It hasn't been as easy. It's been a lot more of a pushback to what they're doing. So
yeah. Yeah. And often, I mean, certainly in the corporate sector, often, you know, DEI roles can be buried within HR. That's where they often live, or within corporate services. Sometimes even they are tied to marketing, which is, you know, really speaks to what we're expecting from the outcome, right? We like the position and the location of the role really does speak a lot to the expectation and the power that we're giving this role. So I'm happy to hear that you feel supported, that you're in the room with decision makers, that people are respecting your experience and the knowledge that you bring to this as a community advocate and as a community organizer. Do you have any advice to give to other organizations who are really looking to start this anti-racism journey, whether it's other municipalities or even in the corporate sector?
I would say nothing is going to be perfect, so don't wait for perfection.
Mm-hmm.
You really have to jump in with 2 feet and take some risks and be prepared to say, I'm sorry, we did this wrong. Let us try again. We can be better, because mistakes will happen. Mm-hmm. I am learning a lot on this journey. I have my own lived experience. I don't have other people's lived experience. And sometimes you just have to sit with that and say, I don't know what the other person is feeling. I don't know what the other person is experiencing. And I have to respect what they're saying to me right now.
Yeah.
And I have to then move forward with that in mind. And how do I then make things inclusive for them as well? So mistakes will be made. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really, really important to recognize that if we wait for perfection, then we're not going to get much done. So you keep moving forward with the work, but yeah, you will mess up.
Yeah. So, well, that's a great, I love that.
Permission to mess up and keep going forward.
Absolutely. And isn't that the truth? I mean, anybody who's been in DEI feels that to the core, because mistakes are absolutely inevitable. And it's not a place where you can afford to be hypersensitive. And you got to just be able to acknowledge your mistakes and move on and do it gracefully and do it with connection. Absolutely. So I really appreciate that as a word of advice. And I appreciate that you've been willing to explore this topic with me. There are, I think, so many lessons that can be drawn from what you've said by folks in governmental or paragovernmental organizations. And I believe the same is also true of corporate sector or other NGO folks out there as well. So I guess as we round the bend here, I want to encourage our listeners to really reflect about, you know, the approach to DEI that Sarah has outlined. So the centrality of her role, the need for an equity lens to be used universally across all policies and programs. And I think another really interesting takeaway is that, you know, regardless of our professional lives, we are all the citizenry of towns and cities where we live. And I do want to encourage folks to dig a little deeper. If you have a passion for equity, the municipal stage is ripe with opportunity for transformation. And there are lots of avenues for people to get involved. So if you're curious about Sarah's work at the City of Guelph, make sure to keep up with her on LinkedIn, and you'll find the link there to Sarah in the show notes. Sarah, I have one last bonus question for you. Is there any person or organization whose work you'd like to amplify here today?
If this is like a shout out, then I'll give the shout out to all the community organizers and folks on the ground doing the hard work. Those are the voices that we need to reach out to listen to, because they are living it and doing it, breathing it every single day, making huge changes with very little resources.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's really, really important to listen to what they have to say and support those organizations in any way that we can. And really, I think my goal is to make policy and programs in a way that allows them to do their work better.
Absolutely.
And I think that's what all municipalities should be aiming for, is how can we make the fundamental, you know, changes at the systemic level to allow people to work better and easier to help those that are really, really in need of help, or elevate them, amplify them in the best ways possible. So
amazing. Yes. Okay. Well, that's great. And I think that is a great reminder for people who work in the corporate sector also to reach out to find those community organizers at the grassroots that are in the community in which your company is operating, and to seek out and ways to support. Sara Sayed, thank you so much for joining us today. And as always, I welcome any of our listeners to reach out to me if you'd like to be a featured guest on this podcast, or if you'd like to sneakily nominate someone. You can find my email in the show notes. And if you like what you're hearing, please leave us a rating and a review, or share this episode to your own socials. It truly does help the podcast get into more ears. I'm Dominique Attrell. Thanks for listening, and see you next time on Just One Cue.